This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 168, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be finding common ground between Britain and Afghanistan with former soldier turned author Patrick Hennessy.
We'll also be joined by medical mythbuster Dr. Ben Goldacre to hear whether the pharmaceutical industry's PR spin does more harm than healing.
And we'll be talking to journalist Brian Cathcart, whose new report, Everybody's Hacked Off, aims to make slightly shorter work of the Leveson inquiry.
That's all to come, plus a look at the week's news ahead and some nice tunes here, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Welcome, Andrew.
I've just got rid of my hiccups.
I wondered what was going to happen as the clock ticked, as the music reached its crescendo, as the green light was lit. I wondered whether you were going to get over that.
Yeah, they've passed. That's good, isn't it?
Phew, man.
Because otherwise it would have been complicated interviewing people about serious subjects. We've got a few serious subjects ahead.
We have, haven't we?
And when you're hiccuping.
We don't want to make light of them, but neither do we want to hiccup through them.
No.
That would be hiccup or hiccough.
That would be a bit rude. You go hiccough.
Ben says hi, by the way.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, just thought he'd keep it. That's what people like,
don't
they?
Keep it in the family.
Keep it in the family. That's what people like when they're listening. They like to hear things like that.
I like Ben.
Yeah.
Now, we won't say who he is. Now, have you had a good week?
Sounds like a euphemism for something. Ben says hi. Slip it under the table. I've had quite a good week. I've had a magazine-y week, largely. It's a rare thing on Monocle 24, in the year of Monocle 24, isn't it? So I've done lots of scribbling. Not that you've seen much of it. You're making a face.
I was like, well, have you really? That's intriguing.
This is the show where I get to do my own PR for fellow Monocle editors. How's your week been? Have you been scrapping? Have you been scrappy-dappy-doo? Have you been...
Well, I could have did a bit of a solo on the Urbanist, my show, because David Michon's away in Vancouver. So yeah. I kind of made the packages, I wrote the copy, I did the whole thing.
That's what the rest of us all do.
I've suddenly realised he's not needed.
He's not, exactly.
David Michon, if you're in Vancouver, don't come back.
Oh, there you go.
No, he should come back. He's welcome back. But yes, I had a lot of radio this week. Reversals. I was doing lots of radio. And I came in for the nice globalist session as well.
Nice. You've got that crink in your hair where you know that you've been wearing the headphones too much during 1 week, when no matter what you do, no matter how many times you wash it, no matter how much product you put in it...
It is odd sometimes when you go to
the headphone crunk.
You go to meet somebody during the day and you go to the bathroom later on and you see that you've got like, they probably think you're a 5-year-old who's spiked their hair. And it's not, it's just the headphones rubbing your.
Thank God headphones don't go the other way, otherwise we'd all be wearing centre partings. Seems like a good time to bring Steve Bloomfield in.
I've got a side parting.
I don't know why I said that.
He's got a quiff.
Yeah, he has got a quiff.
A little bit. That's,
do you tuck your hair underneath? You wears your like a hairband.
A little bit, yeah.
It's like an Alice band.
Yeah, you know, you want to put it out of the way.
And a little pair of court shoes. What's this show turned
into?
It's
my radio look.
Steve is going to look into his news crystal ball, but first he's going to tell us what kind of week he had.
I've had quite a good week, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You sound surprised.
No, it's this was the week in London where we all realised, it's actually autumn. Really happened this week. You know, everyone put their jackets on again, their coats, and wore jumpers instead of T-shirts. But despite all that, despite the weather changes, it's been a good week. Quite exciting. Lots of different bits and pieces. Nice guests.
Who high-fived Kylie this week, by the way? She was in the studio.
I didn't high-five her. Did you high-five her?
Yeah. Well, really? I chatted to her. Tyler interviewed her. I think that's been on already. Show, hasn't it? She's going to be on The Culture Show in a couple of weeks' time. She got a new record, so she came in and did her thing.
Nice.
Best thing.
It was unusual to see the paparazzi outside.
I was
going to
say, exactly, yeah. I kept on walking in and out with my sunglasses on, no interest whatsoever. Kylie comes out.
I did see a nice picture of her in one of the newspapers with carrying the monocle bag.
Exactly.
And did you see who's in the background in that? It's Tommy Serres, Tyler's assistant. Just sort of, you can't see his the top of his head.
Just his
hair. Can see just his mouth and his and the rest of his body. And his sort of mouth's a bit open. Gawping a little bit.
He's a bit too tall, you see, for those pictures. Yeah. It's Kylie. She's quite short.
Yeah, that's why.
They chop your head off.
Why did you see that, Andrew? It's because the Daily Mail Online is your homepage when you switch on your computer. We've had words about this before.
I don't look at any of those sites during the day.
No, just at night.
So we've got, I think we've got what is it called, a packed show.
Yes.
We're talking about Bad Farmer. We're talking about, by the way, that's Farmer with a P. It's not like sort of...
The Bad Farmer.
See, I knew he'd do an accent. I'm from farming stock. I can't afford to do those kind of things, or I'll never be able to go home.
Oh, he's not looking after his sheep, that one. He's all Bad Farmer.
I think you should do the entire interview as if it's about the agricultural industry.
I wish we could redo this whole thing.
Oh, now I understand. Actually, this is serious.
Yeah, it is serious. But first of all, we're going to turn to Steve Bloomfield.
Oh, yeah, my crystal ball of news.
For your weekly news agenda.
Go on, then.
Okay, I thought normally there'd be a little sort of a...
I said it. I sort of said it in a way...
I can do a drum roll on the table.
You did say it in a way that you're expecting someone to play a little sort of...
Have you not got a theme tune for this section yet?
Well, Andrew came up with a theme tune when Tom Edwards was doing the section.
I sang a theme tune for Tom.
I'm not going to do this until a theme tune has been sung.
Well, I think it was especially... It was words that rhymed with Tom. So it's a bit complicated doing it for Steve.
Really?
He's the news bomb.
Oh, yeah.
That's just off the top of my head. So the rest of it you'll have to pay extra for.
Give us
without a theme tune, Steve, or a drum roll, or even a sting.
You could say...
There it is. See?
Right, okay. So, two things I want to talk about. One is going to be quite sort of... It's informal. So informal, they even have the word informal in the title of this meeting. It's the informal meeting of EU ministers of defence. Right. Now, I don't know if it's informal in terms of, you know, shirt sleeves and jumpers or, you know, shoes off. That's sort of informal. Or if it's just, you know, no one's taking minutes.
Maybe it just means leave your bombs in the car park.
Possibly, yes.
I don't know.
It's one of those.
That sounds like quite an interesting meeting.
It's going to be happening in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Okay. Yeah.
That's on Thursday. So, you know, mark your calendars for that.
I learned by reading the newspaper this week that's where they control all the British drones are controlled from there.
Ah, yes.
Well, not from Nicosia, but from Cyprus.
But from their base, the British base in Cyprus.
Yeah. That sounds like a good conference. In the inaugural edition of this spot, the weekly news look ahead with Tom Edwards, he told us about this thing in Vladivostok, which was pretty bad, but that is good. Okay, so this is good.
And then the main thing that's happening next week, which I want to talk about because I'm going to be going to it, is the UN General Assembly. It's happening in New York City.
Fine.
Are you putting the chairs out?
I am. Well, funnily enough,
he's painting the flags. He's putting the letters in the.
I'm security. Okay. I'm the guy at the gate who's like, no, sorry, mate, belt off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm off to New York on. In fact, a little bit later today. To go and cover that. So the UN General Assembly is going to be. It's always a major event because you have most heads of state from all over the world who go there. Now, the key thing, the really important thing, will be who is going to be this year's Gaddafi and make a four-hour speech rambling on and on and on, slagging off pretty much every other country in the world.
Susan Boyle?
I think it's unlikely. I think this will be the first time people will go, you know that Gaddafi fella? We miss him. Mm. So Mugabe is a possible...
Ahmadinejad,
looking forward to his speech.
Sorts of things.
Chavez, if he turns up, that'll be interesting because he's been a little bit poorly, hasn't really been out in public that much. So those are your main contenders.
Right.
But we'll see whether... notable by his absence, I imagine, Bashar al-Assad.
I think the editor of Closer in. French Closer. I mean, the French...
Oh, Closer.
I think she's possibly one of the most sort of unpopular sort of...
only really in amongst certain circles within Britain.
You don't think then that that's as important as Ahmadinejad?
I don't think that, you know, a half-naked duchess is as important as the president of Iran.
Let's see if she took pictures of Ahmadinejad without his top on. I think she would be a bit more worried then.
Yeah.
Yes, she couldn't do that, could she?
She couldn't.
But that's a big proper.
It's a big proper
foreign editor's
shindig. Thing.
A shindig that isn't it, Andrew?
Good drinks afterwards if they've got a drink from every nation.
Oh, you hope so, don't you?
Yes.
Anyway, there'll be serious stuff as well as the speeches and the drinks.
All right, Steve.
There we are. That's my look ahead.
That's a very good look ahead. Next week, we'll see what we can do about rustling up a theme tune, Andrew.
Okay.
Between the two of us.
We can sing something.
Yeah.
What's he got up his new sleeve? Here comes Steve. Something like that.
Oh, man.
Bless, he's been working on it, hasn't he, upstairs?
He's got it written down. He pretended he wasn't reading it.
Yeah.
Steve, thank you very much, and enjoy the UN General Assembly. That doesn't sound... What else can you say? Have a great time at the UN General Assembly.
Have a great time in New York.
Yeah, have a great time in New York.
Cheers.
I'll write you a list.
Thanks.
Coming up next, we're going to be speaking to Patrick Hennessy, who's the author of Kandak, Fighting with Afghans.
We're often led to believe that the war in Afghanistan is an us-and-them struggle, with Western soldiers pitted against Taliban insurgents or working among the rest of a peaceful population. It's easy to forget that Afghanistan has its own army too, playing a vital cooperative role.
Our first guest, Patrick Hennessy, served alongside Afghan troops from 2005 to 2009, and his new book, Kandak, Fighting with Afghans, tells a story of finding camaraderie among conflict. Patrick, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, we'll start with the title, Fighting with Afghans, not against Afghans. That was presumably, because it's a bit of a double-edged phrase.
Yeah, it's nicely ambiguous. I spent 7 months in 2007 working hand in glove with the Afghan National Army, and of course we were on the same side fighting against the insurgents, but you know, there's always friction, there's always tension. They were a very different army, and they did things differently, and so there was always an element that the fighting with Afghans slightly euphemistically alludes to the sort of the other side, and we've seen that sort of tragically recently when there are a number of cases of British, American, Australian guys and girls getting shot by the guys they're supposed to be working alongside.
Patrick, I wanted to pick on that straight away, because it has been an extraordinary period of these both police officers and troops being trained on the Afghan side who have turned against supposedly their comrades. And do you have any inkling of why that is happening now and on such a scale?
I think it's got a lot to do with how much the Afghan security forces have grown. I mean, you look at the army specifically, it's gone from about 50,000 when I was there in 2007. It was about 90,000 when I was back out there in 2009. It's now 200,000. So you're talking about an organisation that's doubled and doubled again in the space of a few years. You simply can't keep up the quality, the level of training, the level of vetting. So I think what we're seeing when you read about these attacks is not a sort of Jason Bourne sleeper cell, a Taliban guy who's joined the army and then been activated later on. It is far more frequently a young soldier who has been through a tremendous lot. I mean, we forget, we do 6 month tours. The Afghans have been fighting the entire time. You know, I've got friends who've been down in Helmand in the Afghan army for 5 years. You know, the levels of things like post-traumatic stress disorder, the stress that they're under, and because of the cultural differences, because of something that can maybe inflame tensions, a misunderstanding, or as we've seen recently with this preposterous film on YouTube, friction builds up and someone just snaps. And unfortunately, that happens in all armies. You look at the history of warfare, there are many examples of armies turning guns on themselves. And tragically, what doesn't get reported here is the number of Afghans who are also shot by Afghans. You know, we talk about green on blue, we talk about Brits being killed by their Afghans. Afghans are also killing Afghans. So I don't think it's as sinister as some people think, but I do think it's symptomatic of a very tired army, and it doesn't suggest that things are going as smoothly as sometimes people would like us to think they are.
That's an interesting point, I guess, the fact that the Afghan army are in their home country. The British and the Americans can sort of, I guess, go in and out, have 6 month tour of duties, refresh themselves a little, even if they're going to go back or not. That's the problem, I guess, isn't it? Do you get a sense of that when you kicked off, when you start the book on this mentor and enable mission?
Yeah. It's really, you feel it very powerfully when you're down there, and it's something that we forget. I mean, as you say, we do 6 month tours, the Americans do year long tours, but you know, during that time that you're going to come home, and you have your eyes on that prize, and quite a lot of soldiers leaving Afghanistan probably think, well, I hope I don't go back. And of course, the Afghans they've been working alongside are permanently down there. And not only that, but they're not rotated within Afghanistan. So the units that are down in Helmand, where the fighting is at its fiercest, they are stuck down in Helmand. And the units that are in the north, where it's slightly quieter, they don't do anything up there to quite the same degree. So the pressure on certain units is much, much higher than even on our units who are out there fighting alongside them.
Now, I was going to say, the heart of your book is this idea of making friendships with Afghans. And could you just tell us a little bit about your personal story there in Afghanistan, how you managed to, you know, kind of break away from just being with the boys, the British boys, and make friends across, you know, across the divide with the Afghan army?
Well, I was in quite an interesting position because I was with a very small team of other British soldiers who were working completely subsumed to within an Afghan unit. So you get that proximity. It's rather like learning a language. You learn a language much more quickly if you're just dropped in a country where no one speaks English. And we had that effect slightly. At times in the book, I sort of slightly despair because the differences between us, culturally, linguistically, they seem to be almost insurmountable. And I think what my unit, or what I and some of the soldiers I was with benefited from, were we fought so closely with these guys that even despite our differences, somehow kind of fighting through an ambush together overcame everything else that was different about us and created a bond. And this is why I'm very worried when we see the more recent response to these sort of attacks is to say, oh, well, we'll stop partnering so much, because actually it's the partnering that brought us together.
And on that front, you sort of say some of the differences, maybe some of the inadequacies are a bit insurmountable. There's a bit that you talk about training with the Gurkhas on Salisbury Plain, yeah. And so they have to pretend to be a bit crap.
Yeah.
And you said they're so good at being, they're such good soldiers that it was sort of important. They kept on, as soon as there was a gunshot, they kind of clicked into soldier mode. But these were aping the Afghans, or the Afghans you were going to go out and meet.
It's a brilliant little kind of vignette which shows how unsophisticated at first our training was, and also how difficult the problem is, because you know we didn't have any Afghans to work with, and so someone thought, oh, well, you know, Gurkhas, they speak a different language. If we instruct them not to speak English and pretend they don't understand English and only respond to a Gurkhali sergeant, then we can mimic the effect of fighting through an interpreter, which is what we all have to do in Afghanistan. But of course, as you say, there is no better natural soldier in the world than a Gurkha, and it's just such an anathema to him not to be good at what he does. So they'd sort of have a slightly cheeky grin and they'd pretend not to understand, but of course they knew perfectly well what you were saying, which was, you know, get down enemy fire and assault that position, and they did it instantaneously. But it's sort of amusing on one level, but if you think about it slightly more, it's also indicative of how we viewed the Afghans, because what we were trying to do was get people to be as bad as they possibly could. And I think, you know, teachers will always say, you know, people respond to expectations. If you expect people to be disastrous, then they will live down to your expectations. And I think at first, in 2007, 2008, 2009, we had such a dim view of what the Afghan army and the Afghan police, who are traditionally even further behind, were capable of, that we didn't really do them justice. And actually what we should have been doing was focusing on the stuff that they're good at, because there's stuff that they were far better at than we were, and trying to kind of bring them on in that direction.
Do you think that both the Afghan soldiers and the forces, the Allied forces, are fighting for exactly the same thing? Because I wonder whether that's where some of the disparity comes, because the ambition of an Afghan soldier, what they're aiming to achieve, is probably quite different from what we're trying to achieve. I think, you know, if you read some of the newspapers here, there's a kind of belief that if the campaign could only go a bit more successfully, we could make it all look like Chelmsford in overnight. But that's not going to happen.
That's a heady ambition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a difficult ambition. No, I think you're absolutely right. I'm not sure the Afghans are fighting for Chelmsford. I mean, it's a real problem, because actually, if we're honest, what most ISAF soldiers are fighting for is to do the best job they can while they're out there and get home safely. And the Afghans that I've spoken to are acutely conscious of that. You know, there is a sense, and I had one Afghan officer, a very charismatic, very difficult, he was a complex guy, he was a brave guy, he was a great soldier, he was sometimes quite scary, but he once said to me, you don't have any commitment here, you're worse than the Russians, because at least the Russians built their barracks out of concrete, and you built all your barracks out of tents. You know, that's how we know you're going home. You're the tourists here. And if, you know, part of the reason why I wrote this book was I had an acute sense of guilt that I'd kind of come in, done my bit, come home, wined and dined with all these stories, and actually these guys were still stuck behind. So I think they are fighting for different things. And of course, the other complexity is that different Afghans are fighting for different things. So the Tajiks and the Hazaras are you know, by and large, very committed to the sort of ideal Afghanistan that ISAF would like to create. In southern Afghanistan, there perhaps isn't such an appetite for that. And some of the Pashtuns in the army, who are traditionally underrepresented, which creates another problem when you're fighting in a mostly Pashtun area, perhaps what they want are different from what we would envisage as a sort of perfect society. So it's a really, really messy conflict.
I love this idea. This is like the George Orwell book that was never written by Andrew Tuck. It's just called Chelmsford. Chelmsford 2012.
The Battle for Chelmsford.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask you, you used a nice acronym there. I wanted to ask you about another one in the book, which is GAFA, which, because I wanted to paint a picture of Kandahar. Yeah. And this was not a term that I hasten to add that you came up with, but no, I think term this, I think is used, the great Afghan fuck all.
Yeah, the gaff. I think it was the Marines, actually.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, you've got these the Hindu Kush, which is just such a dramatic and potent marker. And I remember the first 2 days after we'd landed in Afghanistan, we were so excited to be there. You know, it's the redolence of this country. And we couldn't see it because there was this thick mist that had descended. And then on the third day when it cleared and just this jagged mountain, completely impenetrable. But the south is the desert, the Dasht-e Margo, the desert of death. It's pretty much nothing. I mean, I've travelled reasonably widely, and I can't think of anywhere outside maybe the sort of Mojave Desert in the United States, out in California, that is so sparse and bare. And then you just got Camp Bastion, which is like this military Las Vegas in the middle of it.
And on a serious note, I mean, that is presumably one of the difficulties to find your motivation other than in the men that you meet and fight with. It is battling for a landscape. Do you know what I mean? There is the idea of like, what are we doing here? It makes it more weird when it's a moonscape, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the sort of the times that I've been most pessimistic about what progress, if any, is being made is when I have, you know, the couple of times I went back out after I left the army, or when I speak to friends who are sort of still out there right now, and they're fighting over the same patches of nothing that I fought over now, you know, 5 years ago. And I think that is very difficult. It's very difficult for people at home to understand, you know, why are, you know, kids from Manchester and London dying for a desert which we can't see has any discernible value for people who seem to be so ungrateful that they're turning their weapons on us for doing it. It is very, very difficult.
But do you believe that it is worth the fight? Because it's interesting that this week there'd been another spate of killings, and some of the very, you know, the right-wing press that's supportive of the army have been saying, what's the point? You know, why are we still there? And I think that even for some soldiers, that there is that question, is that, you know, it must come into their mind, what are we doing here? Do you think the fight is worth it?
It's fairly unfashionable at the moment, but I'm a kind of slightly old-fashioned, very ideological kind of liberal interventionist. And it was never, it was always obvious to us down there, well, certainly when I was there, that we weren't making Britain safer. I think part of the failure of kind of political level has been trying to sell this conflict to people on the, oh no, we're in Afghanistan because it makes the streets of your hometown safer. Well, it's been quite clear to everybody for a very long time now that Afghanistan doesn't pose a sort of safe haven to terrorists. And if anything, our presence there probably exacerbates the problem. So that is a nonsense. But I saw and grew to be very fond of a country and a people who had had about as rough a sort of 40 years as is going in world history, and for whom there was no doubt that however difficult the situation was and is now, it is better than it was in 99, 2000, 2001 under the Taliban, and who want every possible support to make sure they don't slip back into that nightmare. And I do think it would be spectacularly selfish of sort of rich Western countries to have gone in, removed whatever threat was posed to them, had a slight commitment, and then thought, oh, you know what, it's now all getting a bit expensive and it's a bit politically unpopular, so we'll just pull out and leave you to kind of deal with the conflagration, which I think would arise if we pull out too quickly.
I thought we were going to end the interview there on the word conflagration. I don't know how to get out of that. The book is Kandak, Fighting with Afghans, and the author is Patrick Hennessy. Thanks a lot for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you.
On the latest edition of Section D, we check out the pocket-sized craft trade fair in Tokyo for stockists. We find out who might be getting their hands on Usain Bolt's bed and what will happen to the rest of the furniture from the Olympic Village. And we visit a pioneering design studio in Ramallah, turning trash into treasure.
When it comes to trash that we know already is a huge problem, that's what we start out by designing, and then we finding the raw material has been the easiest part.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Over the past year, the ongoing Leveson inquiry has called up witnesses ranging from Hugh Grant to political giants such as Tony Blair, in order to get to the bottom of how journalism forgot its ethics amid the phone hacking scandal that started at News International. Making sense of what to do with the evidence is bewildering, but Brian Cathcart,
professor of journalism and founder of the Hacked Off campaign, has published the first digestible report on the findings, fittingly entitled Everybody's Hacked Off. He joins us now to tell us more about it. Brian, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. I wanted to start off, first of all, I think we should perhaps explain what Hacked Off is for people around the world who don't know this organisation, because you're very clear it's a strange grouping of people in every sense.
Yes, I mean, it's a grouping of witnesses, really, who were watching the unfolding phone hacking scandal in this country, which involved the News of the World, the most popular newspaper in the country. And the paper had admitted that one of its reporters had hacked people's voicemails, but denied very strongly that anybody else was involved. And slowly, from 2006 onwards, the evidence was creeping out that this was much more widespread. And a group of like-minded people were observing and collating the evidence and writing about it, and began calling for a public inquiry into what turned into a national scandal.
But what's interesting is you do have the actor Hugh Grant as part of this organisation, and he's written the foreword to your book. And you also have yourself, which is, we should also just make clear, you're not just a professor of journalism, you're a journalist who worked for many years in the industry. So you're casting your eye over a British media landscape where you know many of the characters, and you probably have heard about some of these things yourself as you've kind of worked in the industry. Does it feel a bit kind of strange turning your guns on your own trade in a way?
It does and it doesn't. I recognise exactly what you described. The other day I bumped into, in the street, a man I've known for years who was recently arrested in association with all of this, a journalist, a very prominent journalist. And that feels very strange, very strange indeed. But at the same time, I'm doing this because I love journalism. I'm doing it because journalism is about telling the truth. It's about being a force for good in society. And I think one of the things that hacking reveals is that there are parts of the trade in Britain which have completely lost their way and have never been called to account for all sorts of intrusions in privacy, all sorts of dishonesties, which wouldn't be permitted in any other walk of life and can't be justified in the name of journalism. So I think I'm here to make journalism better, I hope, to make good journalism easier and bad journalism harder.
I wanted to ask you about the writing of the book, Brian. We had BBC News and Sky News. We mustn't forget that they also did cover it. But the rolling coverage of the Leveson Inquiry, sort of men in suits and ladies sitting sort of in a big white room, seemed to be a constant fixture in our newsroom here at Monocle. I wondered how you sort of sifted through it and managed to constantly sort of find the highlights. I mean, were you there every day? Were you watching it on the TV? How were you collating the stuff that goes into the book?
Well, I had to teach classes at the same time, so I couldn't be there every day. But I was spending a lot of time catching up on highlights and reading through evidence, and I've been back over quite a lot of it. And we're a group. You can share out the workload, and people will alert you to the highlights and lowlights, as it were, that you might have missed. So it was practically possible, but you're absolutely right that it was a big enterprise. I mean, this is 9 months of hearings. Something like 500 substantial submissions. I can't remember how many actual witnesses, but an awful lot, day after day after day. I don't think there has been such an in-depth scrutiny into journalism in this country, although there have been many inquiries before, none of them really leading to any substantial change.
I just wanted to actually ask, during the sort of the timeline of the book, I mean, it kicked off in the UK with the Millie Dowler investigation, which was journalists hacking into the phone of this dead girl. And I wonder whether anything worse happens, or whether it is simply the drip down effect, the lack of trust in journalism, especially maybe tabloid journalism, or whether it's that sort of single event that caught people's imaginations.
I think it's certainly the case that the hacking of this 13-year-old girl, who was in fact by then dead, was a tipping point for the British public and caused absolute outrage. And I think you'd find it very hard to find anybody in the street today who didn't, react instantly to that idea. But I think at the same time, getting the picture, getting to where I got writing the book, was about thinking about the future. and trying to, this is my packaging of the story, really, and trying to capture some of the evidence that is most shocking, to remind everybody, so that with the passage of time they don't just become bored, to remind people who might read it, that just how bad it was, and also I think put my own gloss on it, which is I think all of these things are connected. That's to say, there are a whole lot of scandals revealed here in the inquiry. I connect them because I connect them as part of a culture, and I connect them in a way which may not always be obvious, in the sense that it's not that this is a conspiracy where everybody gets together and you know makes a plan across all the national newspapers. It's a conspiracy in which, without having to say a word, newspapers know to cover up. They know to hide the worst of the stuff. So, you know, lots of the worst, including hacking, lots of the worst stories were really never repeated to the readers. You had to find out about them, as Andrew says, by watching television. BBC would give you that. Or by going online, you'd find it reported. Lots of us blogged about it and that sort of thing. But the papers themselves were not telling their readers about that story. And I regard that as an abuse.
Mm. And quite rightfully, you have an agenda as Hacked Off with this book. You know, this isn't just a kind of a summary of events. It really is a tour de force for anyone who reads it. It starts off by telling some of these extraordinary stories. So it's everything from the libeling of the McCanns, the parents of this daughter, this Madeleine McCann, who disappeared, claiming that they were murderers. There's the story, even on the celebrity side, of Sienna Miller, which you maybe kind of don't think it's such a terrible thing, being chased by a paparazzi, but she describes the thing of being chased by 10 guys. And she said, you know, I had to run down dark streets, and if they hadn't got cameras, you know, what would that have really looked like, these 10 huge guys? And you realize a massive, you know, cultural problem, as you say. And do you have some real things that you want to see changed about this? Now, obviously, the Leveson Inquiry could potentially come up with a solution where it takes away the right of this industry to kind of, you know, police its own backyard. And that's what you'd like to see happen, isn't it? You'd like to see something set up where that comes to an end.
Yes. I mean, distinctly, I think that the regulator in the industry, the body that, as it were, polices ethics in the industry, should be independent of the industry itself. It's what we expect in banking, for example, in this country, or indeed in medicine. We need external scrutiny to keep us virtuous. And, I mean, it's a sort of thing to regret that the press has got itself to this stage. But it needs cleaning up. The brand, as it were, of journalism in this country needs decontaminating. And it needs to be done effectively. The industry has regulated itself for 50 or 60 years, and it has made no difference.
Do you think there's a problem, though, for, you know, we've just had one of the papers that actually has not been so caught up in this, the Daily Telegraph, did an extraordinary story of revealing MPs fiddling their expenses. Yeah. So here you have MPs who have been put through the mill by the press, and now we're going to say to them, now you come up with a solution about, you know, how to look after the world of print journalism. Do you think that there is a kind of, there is some queasiness about thinking, do we really want politicians deciding what happens to journalists?
I think there's a natural queasiness, and we're absolutely clear in Hacked Off that if it's to be independent of the industry, it also must be independent of government and parliament. This has to be a standalone body at arm's length from both. But the setting up of it will require, in our view, legislation. Am I queasy that members of parliament will be doing this? One of the things that the proprietors and editors would like you to believe is that members of parliament have been trying to get hold of, you know, strangle the press for years and years and years. The truth is, they've had the option. They've had many opportunities. They've had heaven knows how many provocations. And in every previous occasion, they've shied away from it. So we're saying, you know, and the press has begged for one more last chance. We're saying no more last chances. Let's sort this out. And it is not beyond the wit of man to create something that is at arm's length from both Parliament and the industry, that applies a fair code of practice. In fact, the industry has its own code of practice now, drafted by editors in the industry. I personally think it could do with some improvement, but I would settle for having that code of practice enforced, because it's not at the moment.
And I wanted to ask Brian whether this would have happened, whether your book would have happened if it weren't for the hacking revelations, whether you always had a feeling, you know, as Andrew said, being a journalist, having a career in journalism, whether this was, you knew that this sort of thing was rife or things similar to it or things needed to be tidied up, that they weren't simply to be kept on being swept under the carpet, or whether it kind of took this to sort of steal your reserves of or putting a book together.
I think I used to write a column for the New Statesman about the media. And I suppose back then, which is several years ago, I was already becoming sort of wary. And at the same time, I was teaching young journalists. I was becoming wary about things about the newspaper culture. But I think for me, the trigger, and in fact, the first time I called for a public inquiry into the press, was the McCann case, which Andrew mentioned, in which you have to struggle to get your head around this. Say a dozen national newspapers committed between them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of libels, most of them on the front page, against this couple whose daughter had vanished.
And this is considered okay practice purely because McCann didn't have the money to defend themselves. Is this how it works? Or the time?
I think they just discovered they were getting away with it, and they went on getting away with it. And it was so obviously that disgraceful journalism. You just had to look at it. The allegations were so loosely sourced, as you know, to lead to the suspicion they were made up in a bar in Portugal, very often. And they were mutually contradictory. You know, you'd get the same paper reporting something completely contradictory one week to what it had said a week before. Now, you know, one of them's got to be wrong in those circumstances. But the industry itself was extremely slow to react to this. And in fact, despite hundreds and hundreds of admitted libels in that whole affair, so far as I am aware, no journalist has ever been so much as reprimanded.
Now, can I also ask you, if this was a drama, there would certainly be a baddie in this tale, in the shape of Murdoch. Now, you don't hold your punches in your book. You say he had too much power in the British media, and that had an effect on the kind of journalism that was produced. Do you think that he will now pull out of British journalism bit by bit? He will have lost interest with the game here? Or do you think he's still in print media and online, etc., a power to be reckoned with?
He's certainly still a power to be reckoned with. He still owns the biggest selling newspapers in the country, and he still owns some big banner titles. The Times and the Sunday Times are major international titles. I think his power has been significantly diminished as a result of all this. And I think, you ask, has he lost interest? I think probably he's lost a substantial amount of the interest. One of the curious things about News Corp, his company, his worldwide company, was that I think investors, particularly in the United States, were never really very keen on him owning all these British newspapers, this strange culture that he was connected with. But he personally loved these papers. And, you know, he created the Sun. He bought the News of the World. It was his first big baby outside Australia. You know, he had an emotional connection with them. And he's a natural newspaper man. I mean, you can't take that away from him. He's one of those...
That sounds like a euphemism for something, though, doesn't it? That's the problem. It does, though. It sort of does.
Yeah, he's one of those... There's a great story about him in which, you know, he gets in a dispute with some of the staff, printing staff in the 70s, ancient old printing presses in Fleet Street. And they say, you can't do that. And he says, oh, yes, you can. And he climbs up onto the press and he produces the bits that need to be put into place because he knows they're up there and he knows how presses work. Now, I bet there isn't a single other newspaper proprietor in this country who knows anything about printing presses.
I was just showing me how dirty his hands were there. for the time being, Brian Cathcart, thank you so much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. The book is Everybody's Hacked Off, Why We Don't Have the Press We Deserve and What to Do About It. Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
We're going to have a song now. This is new from St. Vincent and David Byrne from the new record, and it's called Who.
This heavy
And that was Who, which is the first track from Love This Giant, which is from David Byrne and St. Vincent and you, and very fruitful, wouldn't you say?
Very fruitful.
Collaboration. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking to the author of Bad Farmer, Ben Goldacre.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Rob Bound.
For the past few years, via his website, books, and weekly newspaper column, Dr. Ben Goldacre has been calling out the less credible arguments of the medical sector. This week sees the publication of Ben's latest book, Bad Pharma, that casts a critical eye over the pharmaceutical industry's mixed messages. Ben says some are designed to fool the public, and others have managed to fool a few doctors too. He joins us now in the studio. Ben, welcome to the show.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, you start off, you dedicate the book to whom it may concern, which I kind of like that. Presumably it's all of us. Should we all be afraid?
Yes. Well, it is a 90,000 word long letter of complaint. You know, like, you don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book. So I had to find something which could only be explained in a book. And this is a huge problem, and it's a huge problem which has been allowed to persist because it's been hidden from public scrutiny, partly because it's technical, and partly because I think people are reasonably entitled to expect that doctors and senior academics and regulators will fix the problems that I describe. But the fact is they haven't after several decades. And I kind of feel like sunlight is the best disinfectant and shame is a very potent motivator. So I'm hoping that enough people will read this, that it will drive change, because people really do suffer and die unnecessarily. And it's a very, very peculiar situation that we've allowed to arise.
And this isn't bad doctors, this is bad pharma. This is, I mean, you cast most of your ire towards the large pharmaceutical manufacturers, the drug industry.
Well, them, but also the senior doctors and academics and regulators who have either conspired or been complacent and lazy about these problems. You know, I'm not a kind of deranged anti-capitalist, anti-corporate campaigner. We need drug companies to make drugs, and we need drugs in medicine. There is no medicine without medicines. But unfortunately, the incentives are currently so perverse that, firstly, drug companies are allowed to get away with behaving very badly. We know, for example, that half of all of the trials that are conducted never get published. They're withheld from doctors and patients. So we know that we are misled about the true effects of the treatments that we give on a daily basis in medicine. But there are also then kind of interesting second round problems that are created by flawed regulation. So, for example, to get a drug on the market, you don't have to show that it's better than what we currently have. In fact, you don't even have to compare it against what we currently have. And so as a result, the market is absolutely full of these Me Too drugs, copycat drugs. Now, the problem with that is it means that there's no innovation, or it means that the drive to innovation is much less than it should be. So we heard just this week that that a couple of big drug companies are pulling out of Alzheimer's research, for example, saying that they can't get anywhere. Now, there's no doubt that these are difficult problems to solve, but at the same time, with the pharmaceutical industry, we're talking about a $700 billion global industry which spends twice as much of its revenue on marketing as it does on research and development. And that's something which is obviously not going to create innovative new products.
It sounds like Hollywood. It sounds like we're kind of stuck with people not knowing that they're watching crap movies, so we keep on getting the same movie made the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, it really is like kind of Hollywood medicine. It's like X Factor medicine.
Yeah, you know, right.
The bigger you are as a company, the more marketing oomph you've got to put behind a completely bland, uninnovative Me Too drug, the more money you'll get back off it. And that only happens because medical prescribing, medical decision-making, is often driven by marketing rather than by evidence. Now, to be fair, that's a problem that doctors have to take as much responsibility for as the pharmaceutical industry. But at the same time, you know, there's this kind of dance between the senior executives of the drug companies, politicians who don't want to freak out and alienate big drug companies because they're desperate to keep these industries in their countries, and then also senior doctors and senior academics who are, I'm sorry to have to say, often the recipients of, you know, very well-remunerated board positions or, you know, pretty good consultancy rates, who don't want to
not
fix
just free drugs
problem, not just free stimulant medication. No.
But is your problem with, you know, if it was kind of summed up, is it that the drugs, obviously some of these drugs are Me Too drugs, but are you also believing that the efficacy of what ends up being on sale is often not what it claims to be? Are we taking drugs that actually don't work in the way that's claimed?
So it's really important to be clear here that this isn't a story about individual killer drugs. It's about a broken system. So we don't know what the true effects are for all of the drugs that we give. And this is a disaster. But more than that, we also, as well as being misled by people hiding the effects hiding the results of trials that have been conducted, we also don't do the trials that we should be doing. So, for example, nobody has ever done a trial comparing one statin against another statin to see which is best at preventing heart attack and death. You've got endless trials showing that these drugs are better than placebo, better than a dummy sugar pill, better than nothing. But actually, that's not a very informative comparison. So we don't even we don't use the power that we have in medicine to demand good quality evidence from drug companies. We let them get away with producing inferior and uninformative trials, which don't help us understand which drugs we should be giving to which patients.
And do you think that's an industry-wide problem? There was an interesting thing this week out in the US, came some news about some of the big drug companies being fined massive amounts over the recent years, and they've been slightly buried, these fines. And it made you realise that all of these drug companies were coming up against kind of legislators and breaching rules and having problems all over the place. But as you say, they're such a profitable industry that nobody seems to really mind, you know, if they lose a few million here or a few million there in the odd fine or the odd problem, because in the end, they're still making billions.
Yeah, so these big fine stories are really interesting because they're often very underreported in mainstream media because nobody really understands the context of what the fines are being levied for. But also, secondly, they sound like huge amounts of money, but they're just speeding tickets, really. You know, when GSK were fined $3 billion for a mixture of criminal and civil fraud in misleading doctors about which drugs, the extent to which drugs were effective or not, that $3 billion fine was a drop in the ocean. You know, their revenue for only the drugs that they were fined on, only during the period of time covered by those fines, was just under $30 billion. So, you know, these are trivial amounts of money for these huge companies. And that's why these problems have persisted. We don't have adequately muscular regulation, but we also don't have adequate pushback from the medical and academic professions against these problems.
And you know, your book comes up with some ideas. It's not a book that's just a complaint. You have some ideas towards the end of the book about how the industry should be changed and what could be done to shake up this. Because you go for everything from people who put themselves forward to medical trials to the wooing of doctors with gifts. You go through every level showing how at every turn something seems to go wrong. For you, what would be the two or three things that could be done quite simply by legislation to turn around this industry?
So I think there are two main problems. Firstly, the issue of how doctors find out what works and what doesn't has to be fixed. At the moment, you go through medical training. It's maybe 5 or 6 years at medical school, then between 3 and 11 years of postgraduate training. And then you're fully cooked. You go off out into the world and you'll practice medicine for 4 decades without anybody telling you what to do, without ever having any more formal education. And the problem is, the formal education that doctors do get, which they kind of, you know, pick up in an ad hoc fashion, comes for the most part from the pharmaceutical industry. So doctors are being taught about what works and what doesn't work by drug companies. Now, I think that is a problem that has arisen partly because we haven't been sufficiently aware of the need to be better as a medical profession at finding better ways of communicating the effects of medicine to doctors. We're not sufficiently good at getting the right information to the right doctor at the right time. But there's a second problem, which I think is much, much more important, which is that drug companies are still allowed to bury the results of unflattering trials. So you can do 10 trials on a drug, and if only 3 of them show that your drug works, then you publish those and you hand them out to doctors and you flourish them under the nose of commissioners of health services. And the remaining 7, you're still perfectly entitled to bury And every single legislation, every single piece of legislation that's been passed to try and fix that problem has failed to do its job properly. And I think that's something that we need to fix. It's obviously ridiculous that drug companies are allowed to bury half of the results of the trials that they run. And it's research fraud. You know, if I deleted half of the data points in one piece of research, you would quite rightly say I was guilty of research fraud. But if you delete half of the trials that you've run from the medical record, then for some reason that's not treated in the same way. And that's quite wrong, because it's exactly the same insult to the record.
And you believe there should be some kind of amnesty on that?
So I think that we need an amnesty of all the trials that have ever been conducted. I think they need to all be published. And all of the drug companies around the world have records on this stuff, and they're all buried in you know, secure dry storage archives in the hills of Cheshire. And I think, you know, it's a trivial amount of money to just get it all scanned and put it all in a huge public archive and let doctors and academics start picking their way through it and work out what works. And then going forwards, we need legislation that means that drug companies are never again allowed to bury bad data.
And is this a sort of problem of monopoly as well? I mean, these drug companies are humongous, and presumably there are maybe, you know, three or four huge ones in the world. Is that one of the problems as well? The fact that they're not really... Maybe one drug company corners off a certain field of research or marketing and produces one thing, and they don't really have any competitors other than constantly buttering up doctors.
I'm not sure that's true. I think what's happened more is that because they're very incompetently regulated, they're all in a race to the bottom. And there are lots of really interesting illustrations of how perverse that situation is. So just at the beginning of this year, the Australian government said that they were going to do a huge review looking at whether they could regulate the marketing of medicines better. And the Australian medicines industry, which is a membership body that covers about 2/3 of the drug companies in Australia, they went to the government and they said, look, we have this voluntary code of conduct, which has got very high ethical standards, and we'll do the right thing. And actually, we're at a competitive disadvantage because all of the other drug companies, they can all play dirty. And we would like you to raise the bar for everyone. We think everybody should play to our high standards. And they had an independent external reviewer who said exactly the same thing. And for some unknown, bizarre reason, the Australian government decided to ignore this. So they've continued to allow drug companies to play dirty with their marketing tactics. And what was interesting was, you know, there are no sane people campaigning against this stuff, right? You've got loony conspiracy theorists saying that vaccines give you AIDS and sugar pills cure cancer and drug companies are hiding the cure for cancer. And that's all childish and frankly appalling and hugely misses the point. The only person who put out a sensible press release on the Australian government's very stupid decision was the Australian medicines industry. And they put out a press release basically saying, look, you know, it's going to be really difficult for us going forwards to adhere to this very high code of conduct, to these high ethical standards that we've been adhering to, because we've just about been able to keep everybody on board on the promise that one day soon everybody in the industry would have to play cleanly. But actually, you've buggered that up. And now, you know, we don't know that we're going to be able to hold our members to these high standards. So I think it's all about having competent regulation that forces people to play a clean game.
Well, for the time being, put your pills back in your pockets, lads. The book is Bad Pharma. It's out this week. Dr. Ben Goldacre, thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Thanks, boss.
That brings us to the end, Andrew, of episode 169 of The Monocle Weekly.
I think we should be pleased.
I think we flexed our intellectual muscles there, didn't we? Yes. But I like that. I love a show like that. There was so much. We could have had a 1 hour special all on all of those guests. Yeah. Fascinating subjects.
And very nice for me to see Brian Cathcart, because many years ago when I first started working in newspapers, he was one of the editors who I worked with on my very first day. And so to see him again, and I've only bumped into him a couple of times ever since then. And he was an inspiring journalist. And that book is amazing for anybody around the world. It's not just a British issue. It's just great to see somebody kind of really putting down on paper what journalism should be about and what standards should be about and how ethics should work. And it's great. It's not kind of hoity-toity. It's kind of like, it's well written. It's brilliant.
That's what journalism should be in itself. If a book about journalism has got to be a piece of good journalism in itself, like tell a story and be well written and all that stuff, and be slightly prescriptive.
And it's funny because in the UK, Hugh Grant got a bit of flack for kind of saying that he'd been upset by what happened to him in the media, and by pointing the finger slightly as well. But you read his introduction to the book, and it's a good piece of journalism, actually. It's quite powerful writing.
And why not have a flag bearer that people will maybe pick up the book but might not? You need that, right?
I certainly don't think for the world of Monocle and the journalists who work here, there's anything to lose from raising the game generally for the whole media industry, like he suggests.
Are you going to buy everyone a copy?
Buy everyone a copy, then I go and get them some drugs from Bad Pharma.
Yeah. And then what?
Then I also really enjoyed talking.
Then kick back. It's a classic Sunday.
No, I enjoyed talking about Tennessee as well, about Afghanistan. Again, it's just three really interesting people.
And
you and me, five.
Exactly.
Five really interesting people.
Three interesting people in you and I. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and by Paul Noble. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound,
and from me, Andrew Tuck.
Goodbye. Thanks for tuning in.